Book 2, 1924-1934. Chapter 7, 22 September 1924. Clarissa Bender looked round her drawing-room with satisfaction at what she'd achieved. She'd scoured sale-rooms and second-hand shops until she'd found just the right furniture to suit it. The Turkish carpet square had been on the floor when they moved in, but she'd had it beaten and scrubbed regularly until the colours had come up bright and clear. She paused at the window, looking out across what had once been the park. It was a blowy day of fitful sunshine and scudding clouds. Brown leaves were swirling everywhere. This year they were falling early. Already some of the great oaks had bare branches. The signs of autumn saddened her because the room could not be used much over the winter months. The charming Adam-style grate did not throw out enough warmth. Even now she could detect a faint smell of damp underlying that of wood smoke. She pulled up a chair to the escritoire and took out a sheet of notepaper. In large script she wrote, 22 September 1924. She stopped, pen poised. It rankled that the bonds of friendship she'd felt for Hannah Mortimer had slackened. She'd found it hurtful not to be invited to Dorothy's wedding, to know nothing about it until the pictures appeared in the newspapers under the heading of Wedding of the Year. Leo said it was understandable that Dorothy would not want to see her on her wedding day, not when she was the one person who knew her shameful secret. Dorothy had two daughters now, children the Mortimers could be proud of. Not surprising, but even Hannah should no longer hanker after Elizabeth. "Dear Hannah," she wrote, "thank you for your letter enclosing the cheque. I continue to dole out your money for Elizabeth's keep every month. Maisie would never be able to manage one lump sum." She put down the pen and sighed. Everything had changed since that arrangement had been agreed. Only 4 short years, and yet... It wounded her feelings more that Hannah had not invited her to stay ever again, and though she had asked her and Matt for a weekend, Hannah had written back to say Matt had problems at work and couldn't get away just then. They used to come once or twice a year, and Matt had said he enjoyed fishing in their river. She plucked Hannah's letter out of its envelope to reread. "Do let me know how Elizabeth is getting on," she'd written. It seemed she only pretended an interest. "Your friend Hannah takes advantage of you," Leo had said. "She's not like that," Clarissa had protested then. Perhaps circumstances had made her so. But if Hannah felt no guilt at Lizzie's situation, Clarissa certainly did. She had never rated Maisie O'Malley highly as a foster parent. She'd known from the beginning Maisie wanted the money more than she wanted the child. The postmistress would have been a worse choice. Last year she'd done a midnight flit with post-office money. Whether or not she would have taken the child with her, had she been looking after her, was academic. The trouble was, Maisie had just had another son. She'd barely muddled through with Peggy and Joey. Now, with baby Patrick to care for as well, she'd have no energy left to attend to a foster child. Clarissa despaired of the O'Malleys. Maisie and Seamus were turning out to be feckless parents. Even worse, the gatehouse was dirty and overcrowded, and Clarissa suspected Maisie favoured her own at Lizzie's expense. Nobody called her Elizabeth here. She was known as Lizzie O'Malley. All the O'Malley children were ill-cared for and half-wild. Lizzie was no exception, but Clarissa couldn't write that. If Hannah still thought about the child, there was no point in giving her good reason to be anxious. She wrote, "I'm pleased to report Elizabeth is in good health, and is a lively child, bursting with energy and curiosity about everything." Clarissa strongly believed her own children needed others of the same age to play with, and living in the country, there was not a lot of choice. She didn't discourage her boys from playing with the children of the farm workers, and welcomed them if they brought them into the house. But Lizzie was the only one who knocked on the kitchen door and asked straight out if she might come in to play. Clarissa found it strange that she seemed to have more in common with Nick than she did with Lucy. She invented games that they played together. though Lizzie also loved every toy they had. She would have encouraged Lizzie to come more often if she hadn't been so attached to the way-faced Joe O'Malley, and had him so often in tow. He was an impudent little imp, and none of them found him attractive. Clarissa took up her pen again. "Elizabeth is growing prettier, with feathery white hair, big mischievous blue eyes, and a lovely wide smile." She paused. Lizzie was pretty when she was clean. It was easy enough to wipe unsavory smears of food and mud from her face, but usually her hair and clothes were in need of wash, too. Tatty, Clarissa's cook general, was very taken with her. Clarissa had heard her say countless times, "Lizzie's favourite," as she put slices of cake and syrup tart on one side for her. Many times she'd seen her seated at the kitchen table, tucking into hot meals. "Such a thin little scrap. I don't think she gets enough to eat from Maisie." "Lizzie knows what to do about it," Clarissa had said dryly. From time to time she was guilty of giving her biscuits and chocolate herself. She had dread misgivings about Lizzie all the same. Leo had seen her taking eggs from the hen-houses, with Joey O'Malley running behind with a dish to put them in. "Mam sent us," Joey had announced brazenly. "She told us to bring 8, 3 for Dad, and 1 each for the rest of us." Although he was 5 months Lizzie's senior, he was even smaller and thinner, with legs like spindles. He'd been a weakling since he'd had the bout of scarlet fever shortly after Lizzie was born.
"Uncle Seamus needs 3, because he's big and has to work very hard for you," Lizzie said, with round, innocent eyes.
Leo had been about to claim his eggs back.
"Mam says you wouldn't stop Lizzie taking them," Joey had been indignant. "She says you won't mind having them."
So Leo had allowed them to keep the eggs. Clarissa was concerned that Lizzie was being primed by Maisie to steal. She'd seen her take peaches from the greenhouse and heard accounts of marrows disappearing from the garden. One day she'd taken the child aside and explained about ownership, saying Lizzie must ask permission before she took anything that didn't belong to her. The little minx had asked there and then for another 8 eggs, saying Maisie had nothing for their dinner that day. There was no guile about the child. She was just an innocent 4-year-old. Clarissa knew she should never have agreed. She'd taught Lizzie nothing. Maisie and her family were a bad influence on the child, but it wasn't easy to write about these things to Hannah. Clarissa sighed again. Because there was nowhere else Lizzie could go, she'd even toyed with the idea of bringing her into her own home. Leo had been against it. He said she had already infiltrated the kitchen and the playroom, and he didn't want to see more of her, and anyway, she was settled with Maisie, and it would be cruel to pluck her away from poor Joey. "I do miss the long gossipy sessions we used to have," wrote Clarissa. "Couldn't you fit in a long weekend here sometime? I'd love to see you." It might make it easier if Hannah could see Lizzie for herself. She sealed the letter into an envelope and went briskly to the kitchen. Mondays were always busy with washing and churning to be done, so Clarissa was in the habit of preparing lunch on Mondays. Tatty sought to peel the vegetables, of course, and there was usually cold meat left over from the Sunday joint. What she liked doing was making a good substantial pudding to compensate. Leo had a hearty appetite. The kitchens at Yarrow Hall Farm were immense. A warren of storerooms, galleries, pantries and dairies, and one big room heated by an auger where the cooking took place. Today the windows ran with moisture. The room opposite was fitted with a deep brown sink topped by a single cold tap and was used for laundry. Every Monday a fire was lit under the big boiler in the corner to heat the water and boil the whites. The steam got everywhere. As she rolled out the pastry, Clarissa was aware of Lizzie's alert blue eyes watching every move she made. 2 grubby fists clutched the edge of the table. Her chin just cleared it.
"Blackberry pie? That sounds lovely. I wish I could make things like that. Will I be able to when I'm bigger?"
"Yes, I'm sure you will."
"Why are you stretching it out?"
"To cover this plate."
"But you've done it once. Are you making 2 pies?"
"No, a base and a lid."
Tatty?
Lizzie turned as the woman bustled in from the laundry, her hands white and wrinkled from long immersion in water.
Can you make blackberry pie?
Yes, of course, Clarissa answered for her.
I don't think Auntie Maisie can.
The child was frowning. She could if she wanted to. Tatty sniffed on her way out again. Clarissa expertly slashed the overhanging pastry from the plate. Come on, if you gather up these trimmings, you can practice now.
Can I? I'd love to.
Better wash your hands first. The rinse Lizzie gave them was perfunctory. Bring the footstool so you can reach. Clarissa floured the marble slab in readiness. Lizzie found the rolling pin unwieldy.
Am I doing it right?
Don't thump it. More like this.
My pastry's got creases in it. Yours was smooth.
You must roll them out. Clarissa had to smile. The child was so full of enthusiasm it was impossible not to be drawn to her. She shot a disapproving glance at Joey O'Malley, asleep in the old basket chair by the arger. Joey won't sleep tonight.
He didn't sleep last night, Lizzie said. Uncle Seamus was after him with his belt.
Why? Clarissa knew her voice was sharper. She'd heard rumours about Seamus belting his children with a heavy hand.
Joey didn't bring in any sticks for morning.
Lizzie was concentrating on rolling out the pastry, the tip of her tongue gripped between milk teeth. Oh! It seemed harsh punishment for such an offence from a four-year-old.
It's our Joey's job, you see,
Lizzie said earnestly,
to collect sticks to light fires. There's plenty in the park, Uncle Seamus said he was lazy. Joey's supposed to bring them in before they're needed, to make sure they're dry. But he didn't, and the sticks ran out. Joey said Aunt Maisie used too many. He's got marks on his back from the belt.
Clarissa asked faintly, Do you have a job?
We all have. Peggy washes and changes the baby. She's going to feed it, too, when it learns to eat food.
Leo said Clarissa should not allow Lizzie free access to their kitchen. At first she'd come alone, waiting until Tatty welcomed her with meals and cups of broth, and only then introducing Joey to the same largesse. Clarissa found it hard to believe any child could be so devious as to think out a strategy like that. She had always begged for little tidbits to take to Joey.
Poor Joey is hungry,
she'd say to Tatty, and little offerings of cake and biscuits would be handed over to him, too. Now Joey frequently drowsed in the basket chair, while Lizzie followed Tatty from pantry to scullery and back, chattering all the time. What job has Maisie given you?
I collect the milk every morning.
There was a touch of pride in her voice. Clarissa caught her breath. From our dairy? She knew, but up to now Leo had allowed his workers all the milk they wanted, after the cream had been taken off for butter-making. But now he was arranging to sell fresh milk instead, and he was worried his farm workers would resent being cut down to a couple of pints daily. He said the O'Malleys got through a gallon most days.
I take our biggest jug, Lizzie said.
Sometimes I go twice, and we have milk puddings.
And it's my job to fill up the sauce bottle for Peggy.
What sauce bottle? She felt mystified.
An okay sauce bottle. Peggy takes milk to school in it.
Yes, of course, Clarissa said absently. Lizzie let the kitchen door slam behind her and Joey. Slowly they crossed the yard, each carrying a pastry man on an outstretched palm. Now that Yarrow Hall had become a working farm, the centre of activity had moved from the front of the house to the back. What had once been rose garden and shrubberies had become the farmyard. Barns, cowsheds and stables had been put up. Implement sheds and chicken houses had been added. Lizzie nibbled.
I made that specially for you. Mine's still warm.
Pastry looks a bit grey. Joey picked off the currants that represented eyes. Tastes all right, though. Do you want all of yours?
Yes, you've got your share.
Mrs. Bender lets you do anything you want, he said enviously. Go upstairs to play with Lucy and Nick sometimes.
She showed me how to make pastry. She likes me a lot.
How do you know?
I feel it. She gives me a warm feeling.
She doesn't like me, Joey said resentfully. I suppose you like her?
Yes, she's kind.
Do you like her better than me?
I like you best, Lizzie said. You know that.
Yes, he said gruffly. You and me are twins.
Not real twins.
Better than real twins.
Mrs. Bender feels sorry for me. Tatty and Mavanwi are sorry for me, too.
Everybody calls me poor Joey, so it stands to reason they should be sorrier for me. But she doesn't let me do what I want, just you. You're different from the rest of us. She'll let you do anything.
Not absolutely everything.
Lizzie crammed pastry into her mouth. Washing was fluttering above them on two long lines.
That's Lucy's best frock, the one with birds on it. I wish I could have a dress like that.
You could take it, Joey said. Mrs. Bender wouldn't stop you.
I think she would, but I'd love it.
Go on, take it. It's the only way. Shall I let the prop down? He was already doing it. The line of washing descended, but she still couldn't reach the frock. Lizzie glanced guiltily back to the house, but the kitchen windows were running with moisture. Nobody would see her take it. Joey gripped her round the thighs and tried to hoist her the few inches she needed. She pulled on the bottom of the garment but could not reach up to the pegs. Joey just hadn't the strength to lift her high enough. She collapsed back on the ground, and they both doubled up in a fit of the giggles.
"I know," she said, "something to stand on. Over there, look."
A pile of logs had been brought to the yard and were waiting to be split ready for the auger. They chose a piece of tree trunk and together rolled it into position. Joey pulled on the hem, and now she could reach high enough. Seconds later, the frock and two pegs were in her hand.
"What are you two up to?"
a deep voice bellowed at them. Joey was off like a rabbit. Lizzie turned to run, but two strong arms enclosed her and jerked her up. She found Mr. Bender's angry face only inches from her own. Shocked, she hit her face against his shoulder.
"What's this you've taken, you little imp?"
She was wriggling, trying to get down on her feet. His arms were a vice-like grip.
"Who said you could take Lucy's dress? It is Lucy's, isn't it?"
Lizzie was filled with shame.
"Nobody gave you permission, did they? Come on, you can put it back. It's still wet."
She was struggling hard, but couldn't escape his arms.
"Come on, peg it out properly."
Lizzie opened her mouth and howled with fright. She could barely see the line for tears. Mr. Bender had such authority she dared not refuse.
"Caught you out, didn't I?"
He was holding her up to do it. Reluctantly, she did as he ordered.
"That's better, apart from the dreadful noise. Stop it this minute or I'll give you good reason to cry."
Almost before Lizzie realized his intention, he'd put one foot on the log they'd rolled under the line and tossed her over his knee. She felt his hand deliver a powerful wallop to her bottom. She howled louder, struggled harder.
"Don't ever take anything unless you have permission. Not anything," he was saying sternly. "Do you hear?"
Lizzie was ready to promise anything to stop the heavy-handed whacking she was getting. Suddenly something launched itself at Leo Bender. She felt him lurch under the impact, and his grip on her relaxed.
"Come on!"
Joey hissed urgently, and he was towing her out of the yard as fast as he could go. Her buttocks were stinging. They hurt more as she tried to run. She heard Mr. Bender shout angrily,
"Clarissa, see what your little protégé is up to now!"
Joey let her pause to get her breath back when they reached the corner of an outhouse. It added to the indignity to see Clarissa come to the kitchen door, concern on her face.
"What is it, Leo?"
"Someone has to teach her a lesson. She helps herself to everything we have. Nothing's safe."
"Poor Lizzie."
Joey's arm went around her shoulders and pulled her close. She burst into noisy tears, but they were tears of relief and gratitude. Joey was the one person who understood how she felt.
"I dropped my pastry man," she lamented. The hens are fighting over it. Just look.
Hannah remembered studying the embossed invitation for 5 August 1927 before enclosing it in her letter to Matt. She'd wondered then whether he'd come, because he'd already been home this year in June, and it didn't give him much time to make arrangements. Greg had given them no inkling then. The years seemed to be passing so quickly. She'd grown used to Matt's absence in Egypt. He'd said he much preferred working there to being at home and running Evans's. Now Hannah shuffled on the hard pew, half mesmerized by the familiar words.
"Gregory, wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife, to live together?"
Seated in the pew in front, Eunice's plump shoulders were ramrod stiff with disapproval. Not disapproval of Matt, though she thought he should have come, but disapproval of the bride.
"Throwing himself away?"
She'd been outraged when first told of Greg's intention.
"It'll never last."
Darcy Wentworth was 8 years older than Greg, the widow of a photographer with a 5-year-old daughter. That was bad enough. What Eunice couldn't stomach was that Dulcie had been his housekeeper. Hannah assumed Dulcie had found him easier to live with than she had. She'd had a row with Greg because he'd gone away without telling her when she'd had meals prepared for him. He'd come home 3 days later and said he'd been in Doncaster at a race meeting. She'd already eaten her dinner that night, and he'd had the gall to complain because there was nothing prepared for him. She said, "I'm not going to be treated in this way, Greg. You'll have to show more consideration. Either you tell me in advance what your movements are going to be, or you'll have to leave Oak Ridge." He'd moved his things out the following week, and she hadn't been invited to see his new quarters. Dulcie's daughter Fay was fidgeting in the aisle. Dressed in a blue bridesmaid's dress, she seemed to find uncomfortable. Now she was scratching her arm. Dorothy's two little girls, similarly dressed, behaved with greater decorum. Hannah studied the bride's back view. Elegant cream oyster satin veiled in masses of fine net with a train that dragged the floor. An up-to-the-minute wedding gown that looked scant and loose and straight from the front and showed the bride's knees. Greg's handsome shoulders towered over hers. They made a lovely couple, and at least he'd managed to get Dulcie to the altar. Greg had been formally engaged 3 times before, and each time the bride-to-be had changed her mind before the wedding. The ceremony was coming to an end. While the bride and groom were signing the register in the vestry, Hannah noticed that the church had grown dark, though it was midday. As the bride came down the aisle on her new husband's arm, and Purcell's trumpet voluntary was being performed with great verve on the organ, lightning flashed, and a tremendous rumble of thunder drowned it out. The bride's little daughter disgraced herself, screaming and clinging on to her mother's dress. After the next clap of thunder, Eunice's voice carried clearly up the church, praising Franklin's daughters for not making such a silly show of themselves. Hugo lifted his top hat from the seat, where he'd used it to gain space between himself and Eunice. Hannah saw the look of disdain he gave Eunice as he stood back to let her go out ahead of him. Hannah went to scoop the frightened Fay into her arms to comfort her, but she wouldn't stop pulling her mother's dress into unsightly creases and showing more of the bridal legs than was seemly. It seemed heaven disapproved of this marriage, too. Outside, the rain was coming down in sheets. The official photographer, together with several press photographers, braved it to snap 2 or 3 times at the bride and groom in the church door, while the guests crowded the porch behind them. Then Hugo was summoning the cars to come as close as possible. Once Fay had been dispatched with the bride and groom in the same Isotta Fraschini sporting tourer that had been bought for Dorothy's wedding, all formality went. Umbrellas were produced, and guests were crowded into cars as quickly as possible to get them out of the wet. Eunice had agreed to arrange the reception, but she wasn't making anything like the fuss she'd made for Dorothy. The guest list was much smaller. A marquee had been erected on the lawn. The ladies with satin slippers and open shoes got their feet damp crossing the grass. Hannah felt Hugo take her arm and run her across under an umbrella, huddling close to keep her dry. For the last few years, her only contact with the Mortimer family had been through him. He asked her to family gatherings at Ince at Christmas and for his birthday. Every few months he would take her out to lunch. She knew he was spending time alone at Ince while Eunice stayed in London. She had invited him to an occasional meal at Oak Ridge, but always with other people. "To play host for you while Matt is away," he'd suggested, his blue eyes twinkling down at her. "To help the conversation along, Hugo." He was good at that, always friendly but very proper. "I enjoy coming to your home," he'd said one night when he was leaving. Occasionally he'd drop in unannounced at tea time and spend an hour or so with her. Hannah thought of him as a friend. The champagne flowed, the feast was excellent, and the wedding cake had five tiers again. But the tent was dank, and the light pale mud-coloured as it came through the canvas. The drumming of rain was only too audible. Franklin Flower, his prominent teeth showing below his moustache, towed a little girl by each hand, while Dorothy whirled through the guests oblivious to her family. Hugo was full of gossip, as always.
"Would you say Dorothy was cooling towards Franklin?"
"She's cool towards everybody."
"And did you notice," he chuckled, "Eunice didn't kiss the bride?"
"But you did twice to make up," Hannah smiled, "so perhaps the bride didn't notice." She'd felt even closer to Hugo since the general strike last year. Throughout the 9-day crisis, he'd come to Oak Ridge many times. He'd been very worried, not only about the national situation, but also about his own factories, which had been brought to a standstill by lack of coal and other supplies.
"Thank you, Hannah," he'd said when it was over, "for listening to my fears and outpourings. You help keep me sane."
She felt she'd learned a good deal about the economic and industrial troubles the country had gone through since the end of the Great War. The Mortimer connections began making for the greater comfort of the house as soon as they'd eaten their fill of the buffet and the speeches had been given. The dubious comfort of the Marquis was being left to the bride's friends and relatives. "Let's go," Hugo said, picking up their glasses and a full bottle of champagne from the table. "It stopped raining at last." The house seemed full of people, too. He led her up to his study. "What's up here?" Hannah peered up the circular stairs to the cupola.
"Let's go up, and I'll show you. Here, you carry the bottle."
The stairs were steep and narrow and winding. Hannah marvelled at the ease with which Hugo climbed up. When she reached the top and was able to see over the trees, she gasped with pleasure at the view spread out below. It was late afternoon. The sky had cleared, and the first watery shafts of sunlight were coming through. She could see for miles, out over Bromborough Docks and downriver to the Liverpool skyline.
"Have a look through my telescope. You can see the people on the landing stage."
Hannah trained his telescope on the Liverpool shore. The atmosphere had been washed clear of smoke and haze. Every detail, every street, every house seemed to stand out with utmost clarity. She could even see raindrops sparkling on the distant roofs.
"I love it when it's clear like this," Hugo said, and bent closer to show her how to adjust his instrument to suit her eyes.
His thick white hair brushed her arm. Hannah felt a tingle of desire. She straightened up, surprised, shocked at herself. He noticed and smiled at her.
"The cathedral looks wonderful. They say it's almost finished now."
She felt something pass between them, a yearning, a thrill, and realized she'd loved Hugo for a long time. A pall of guilt followed quickly. He was, after all, her father-in-law.